You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on this fine Friday. Almost, we're getting down to the wire. There's one more Friday in Lent after this one. And then it's Good Friday, amazingly. This Lent has just flown past. I'm kind of amazed by it. But thought I'd spend a little time today. We are experiencing a bit of a lag for our normal Friday guest. Our Friday co-host is Doug O'Brien, and he should be here, but I think he's slowed down by something. So I thought I'd spend a little time and talk about what the church means by infallibility. Infallibility is one of those claims that the church does in fact make, which of course messes everybody up. People freak out. A lot of Catholics freak out by the church's claim to infallibility, because what it sounds like is the church is saying, we're never wrong about anything, ever. We've never been wrong. And we never will be wrong, because we are just unbelievably arrogant. And we're just going to go ahead and keep saying this, even though everybody knows that Catholics have been wrong about all kinds of things. But we're just going to go on saying that because we're stubborn. That's a lot of people just can't believe it when they hear a word like infallibility applied to the church, because that's how it sounds to them. The thing is, of course, none of that is what the church means by infallibility. So, and you know, anyone can see that, of course, because the church is, for one thing, the church is constantly issuing apologies for things, you know. All these terrible things that Catholics do, including bishops and popes and all the rest of it. So, for example, when we began the third millennium, in the years leading up to the third millennium, that was kind of all Pope John Paul did, was go around and offer apologies for everything that he could think of that the church had done wrong in the previous millennium. It was a kind of a cleansing of memory, or what you might even call, you know, examination of conscience or penance, that he led the church in doing. And there's a reason for that, of course. It's that infallibility doesn't mean never having to say you're sorry. Infallibility, as we will see, is actually a remarkably humble claim. And yeah, I know that sounds ridiculous. But in fact, that's what it is, because all infallibility really means is that it's the church's confession that we are such a pack of ding-dongs and screw-ups and idiots and ignoramai, if that's the right word, that if the Holy Spirit were not guiding the church, we would not have gotten to evening of Pentecost 2,000 years ago, before we had completely lost track of the gospel and hopelessly screwed everything up forever. So infallibility is, you know, think of the comedy where the guy has a fairy godmother, you know, the nebbish who can't do anything right and who's always doing stupid things, but has a fairy godmother who helps him out and gets him out of jams and supplies him with the help that he needs so he doesn't completely screw up his life. That's essentially what we're talking about when we're talking about the church's charism of infallibility, except in place of a fairy godmother, what we're talking about is the Holy Spirit. So I wanted to read a piece that I wrote some years ago that kind of talks about how I got the hang of what the church is talking about when it's talking about infallibility, because like anybody else, when I first ran across the term, I thought, give me a break. Infallibility, seriously? I mean, come on. You know, look at the history of the church. So, there is no greater scandal among moderns than the church's claim to infallibility. And who can blame them? Because, you know, as the last century drew to a close and the new one opened, especially with the priest scandals, it did look as though only a cretin could seriously believe any institution possesses modest integrity, much less infallibility. We've been so schooled in cynicism with, you know, take your pick, Watergate, Vietnam, Kennedy affairs. Those are all things that happened in my youth. But since then, of course, we've had the priest scandal, people injected with plutonium. I mean, take your pick, you know. So when we read of Borgia popes and pedophile priests and, you know, the radical nuns praying to Diana of the Ephesians and, infallibility just sounds ridiculous. And yet, here is this strange divine sea of a church embraced by apparently rational, intelligent, good people and more of them converts. Who seriously subscribe to this dogma that the Holy Catholic Church is in very truth infallible. Why? Well, here's my story for what it's worth. I am an aging dinosaur. I came of age intellectually in the 70s. And I'm from Seattle, which is the least church city and the least church state in the nation. And so I ate and drank and breathed like everybody in my generation, a kind of a hazy philosophy of relativism and open-mindedness. And for anyone, especially Christians and especially the Catholic Church, to make a dogmatic statement about some matter of metaphysical truth was regarded as embarrassing and silly in the extreme. And though I came to a kind of, you could call it a Protestant faith, although I never did, in 1979, for a very simple reason, I wasn't protesting anything. I became a believer in 1979 in this little non-denominational evangelical church out here in Seattle that existed at the time. But even though I came to faith in Jesus, I retained for years afterwards this deep kind of conviction that only the openness and liberalism of a secular culture could temper Christianity's dangerous dogmatism. Dogma was dangerous by definition in my thought, because as a new believer, I had no idea what dogma meant. My assumption was dogma was where the Catholic Church tells people, shut up, if I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. There's nobody more dogmatic than somebody who does not know what the word dogma means. So I was absolutely certain I was right about that. But odd things were afoot in my open secular culture that I was from. And I was watching, I began to realize that there were a lot of dogmatic isms that were flowing through the academy. I went to the University of Washington, studied English at just the time when Shakespeare was starting to become forbidden because he was a dead white European male. And, you know, all the rest of us, I watched as, deconstructionism took over at the academy. And deconstructionism, you know, being at once the assertion that all language is political and has no ultimate meaning except as a tool of political control, which results in lots of academic conferences in which you present, 30 pages of closely reasoned prose arguing that language has no meaning, and then you break for lunch and argue with the waitress about the bill because that certainly has meaning. And so I was watching as the sort of in the 80s, this kind of push for a kind of open-mindedness that was remarkably closed. And that started to bother me because I began to realize that all of this open-mindedness tended to have one direction. And it was toward arguments for power and not arguments for truth. And an embrace of a might makes right philosophy. That philosophy, unfortunately, now has also taken root on the right. This is largely going on in the left in those days. But it's metastasizing. And the loser at, in all of these arguments is truth. And so I've watched, you know, to my horror, I've watched in the last few years as even conservative Christians have embraced this. You know, this is why excuses continue to be made for a man like Donald Trump, who lies all the time. But he won, and therefore that's good. And that whole push away from the use of language for truth and toward the use of language for power really started to bug me. It bugged me back in the 80s as I was starting to deepen in my Christian faith. And we'll talk about that more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back on Redbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And guess what? Over the break, I was joined by Mr. Doug O'Brien. So yes. Our technical issues are past and all is well. I was talking a little bit about infallibility. Because infallibility was one of those things that, you know, when I came into the church, I was like, yeah, right, you know. But the more I started looking at it, the more I began to realize that there was once I understood what the church actually meant by infallibility, it made a lot of sense. I came from the kind of the you know the world of secular relativism of Seattle and so forth, and still very much you know that's the culture. And the idea, of course, was that infallibility was rigid and closed to new ideas and so on and so forth. And what we needed to do was keep an open mind. And the irony was that I worked at the University of Washington for a long time. And it embraced all of that. And the result was tremendous intolerance.
Right.
Because there were, you know, there were correct things that you could think and say. And then if you did not think and say those things, you were incorrect and a bad, bad person, you know. And I've watched that mindset actually progress into a kind of the best description I've heard of it is kind of a whole society that's been broken up into lots of tiny ideological bubbles, and you live in your ideological bubble, and you don't go outside of it, and you don't allow yourself to think thoughts that are not accepted within that bubble. And if you do, you are a traitor. And unfortunately, that kind of mindset has metastasized, and it's metastasized even worse, I think, now on the American right, both within the church and without. There are things and people that you can think about and listen to, and then there are things and people that you must not think about and listen to. And if you do, you're a traitor. Or you're listening to fake news, or you're, right. you're outside the tribe.
But you'd have to say, though, I think you'd agree, is that while I like to take a swipe at the American right more than most people, the American left has got that pretty well down pat too.
They invented it.
Yeah, I mean, visit any college campus and
right.
And you get that pretty, in space.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about. When I first encountered this, it was at the University of Washington in the 1980s. And yeah, I mean, that was when the term political correctness was coined.
Right.
And it was all about, there were things that you could and could not say and do. When I became a Catholic, part of the reason I was attracted to what might be called conservative Catholicism was precisely that you weren't under those kinds of, suffocating restrictions of what you could think about and talk about.
But doesn't this, I want you a question though, but see, this is the thing that I think puts you and me and many people that you and I are friends and heroes. It's because we're not in either one of those bubbles, right? You feel like in American culture, and certainly in American political culture, you don't really have a home, right?
Exactly right.
Because you can't. And that to me is actually kind of one of the lonelinesses of this reality of our society today. That, Breitbart News is not where I'm going to get my information, nor will it be, frankly, the New York Times has its issues too. So, it creates an impasse. It creates this impassibility then to real political discourse to solve real problems that we face as a society.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I was so grateful for when I became a Catholic was that I got to know Dominicans. There's a Dominican parish. And the great thing about the Dominican intellectual tradition is that it is rooted in the conviction that all truth is God's truth, and so you don't have to be afraid of the truth. You're not going to find some truth. You might find some truth that's going to challenge you, and make life difficult for you because it means that you'll have to change. But you don't have to be afraid. As a Dominican, this is drilled into me by the Dominicans, you do not have to be afraid that you're going to run across a truth that is going to shatter your faith. It's going to destroy, all other what you thought was true. That once you've ascertained a truth, that stays there. And I was really grateful for that because it meant that there was a real freedom to explore the world and to learn about the world, because that the same world that was redeemed by Christ is also the world that was made by him. And so there's not a contradiction between creation and therefore the sciences, for example. And salvation and the truths that are revealed through Christ. And that was a huge and liberating thing for me. And so it was one of the things that I really appreciated. And one of the great sadnesses of my life has been watching the imprisonment of a lot of conservative Catholicism to the ideological commitments of American political conservatism, which are not at all the same thing. And it's resulted in a similar kind of enslavement that I watched go on at the University of Washington on the left in the 80s. You must not think or talk about this because our political tribe demands this, that you not, or if you do think or talk about it, it can only be in these terms. And if you, you know, if you speak to or cite from this ritually impure source or that, you know, ritually impure person, then somehow you are tainted and you are, you know, you're outside the fold. And, you know, the Catholic faith doesn't do that. We do that. And now it's happening on both sides. And the upshot of it was this, that I realized that the church's teaching on infallibility actually was a bulwark against that kind of thing, because the first confession that infallibility makes is that we're all a bunch of screw-ups. And so we need the help of God, and we're never going to have some system that's going to have it all figured out. What an ideology tries to do is it tries to whittle all the truth down to fit into some simplicity. So everything is evolution, or everything is electricity, or everything is money, or everything is genetics. Exactly. And the paradox of infallibility is infallibility says, we don't know hardly anything about this big, weird universe. Here is the one thing that we do know. We know that, I believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and so on. The church says this is the only thing that we actually know as Catholics. For sure. And the rest of it is like, that's kind of the job of people with relevant competencies to talk about. So we don't have some big system to all explaining system of economics or politics, or, you know, we don't know everything about the sciences. So we'll just leave that to scientists to let them work that out. And we're not going to tell them how to do their business. And I found that tremendously liberating.
Which, by the way, I want to add one point, is that it's not that they're allowed to do those disciplines, right?
Right.
With great freedom. And I think that's what's lost to Protestants and non-Catholics. They don't understand it's the great freedom. And that the church, and it's not like the church is disinterested. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It is completely interested in it, right?
Right.
And that's the irony of this, is that we are not anti-scientific. We're actually very interested in science, and the church wants to be, you know, part of that that engagement,
right?
To know the Creator better and to know the Creator's creation better, and that applies across every discipline.
Yeah, and the church is, in fact, the mother of the sciences, which a lot of people don't realize, is that science was invented in late medieval Latin Europe and nowhere else.
Right.
There are other things that are kind of pre-scientific. So, you know, Egyptians invented mathematics, for example. And, you know, and you have explorations, certainly of thought. But the scientific method was invented in late medieval Latin Europe. And it came out of, we'll talk about this when we return, but it came out of two really crucial insights that owe to the Christian and Catholic tradition. And we'll be back talking about that right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Douglas O'Brien, and we will be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Douglas O'Brien, Douglas Aloysius Francis
Patrick.
O'Brien. And on the last day of this month of the Irish, and then tomorrow we can all be fools, and that'll be great. So, you know why it's called April Fools?
Whoa.
Because April 1st used to be the first day of the year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's right. And then they moved it to January 1st. But yeah. So anyway, but before we went to break, we were talking about the church's claim of infallibility. All the church's claim of infallibility really boils down to is that despite the fact that we're such screw-ups, the Holy Spirit will not let the church alter in some fundamental way the tradition that has been handed down to it by Jesus and the apostles. That's really all it means. And so it doesn't mean that the Pope can't make a mistake. The Pope has made plenty of mistakes and will continue to do so. It doesn't mean that the church in council can't make a mistake. So, for example, the church in the Council of Trent, apparently somebody at the Council of Trent thought it would be a good idea to paint clothes on St. Catherine of Siena or St. Catherine of Alexandria in Michelangelo's Last Supper painting because they didn't like that she was naked. Was that an infallible act? No, that was just a dumb artistic choice by some council father who thought that that would be a good idea. But what it does mean is that when it pertains to faith and morals, the church will not drop the ball and define falsehood as truth. And that means a couple of things. It means that, first of all, that the church is still free to progress. The church can think about its tradition more deeply and come to conclusions about it. So, you know, the first time we saw that happen was in Acts chapter 15, when the church had to sit down and have a good think about what do we do about Gentiles coming into the church. Are they supposed to be circumcised and keeping kosher and all that or not? And what the church realized was, no, Gentiles don't need to do that because the kosher laws and the purity laws and the circumcision laws were all symbols and shadows that had been pointing to Christ. Well, now that he was here, the Gentiles don't need the symbols and shadows. What they need is Christ. And so the church developed its teaching. And it's done that down through the ages and worked out questions like, who is Jesus exactly? And, you know, what are we to make of the Blessed Virgin Mary and all kinds of other things that the church has defined? And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about infallibility, is the church coming to more deeply understand its own tradition and being guided by the Holy Spirit. But as a result of that, almost everything else in life is not dogmatically defined by the church. The church has very little dogma to show for about 2,000 years of pondering its tradition, because most of what it does is prudential judgments about how to live, how to act, what to do in a particular cultural setting. There's not a lot in the New Testament giving us direct instruction about embryonic stem cell research, or tariffs, or all of those kinds of things. And so the church gives us guidance, about how to think about those things. But at the same time, it gives us an awful lot of leeway in how we're going to order our common life. And so it doesn't micromanage things, and it doesn't tell scientists how to do DNA research. It tells us certain moral guidelines. So don't clone human beings is one such guideline. Because why? Well, because human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and they have their own dignity and integrity, and they are not products. They're people. But at the same time, you know, the church, there have been times when the church has meddled in issues that it ought not to have meddled in. So, for example, with Galileo. But what's remarkable about Galileo is how isolated he is in the history of the church in terms of the church making a bad judgment call with him. The church mostly has been the patron of the sciences. And the reason that the sciences came out of a Christian culture is because a Christian culture took as its foundation stone two ideas that were absolutely essential to the emergence of a scientific worldview. The first was that the universe functioned lawfully because it had a lawgiver, which we take for granted. We don't take the lawgiver part for granted anymore, but we still take the lawfulness part for granted. So every time an atheist says that miracles can't happen because physical laws forbid them, he's still worshiping if you will, sort of the ghost of the lawgiver. He doesn't believe that there's a lawgiver anymore, but he still believes that there's a law of gravity, or that you know, light can't go any faster than 186,000 miles per second because that's the law, and not just a good idea. And you know, virgins can't conceive because we know about biological laws and facts and so forth. Well, all of that comes from a Christian tradition that said that the universe behaves lawfully because there's a lawgiver. And that's not necessarily a given. There were whole civilizations who didn't think that at all.
Right.
So this, you know, the ancient Sumerians saw no lawgivers. They just saw, you know, chaotic floods that swept their towns away sometimes. Who knows why? Because the gods are capricious jerks, you know. And so if you don't believe that there are laws there, you're not going to study them. You're not going to look for them. You're not going to expect them to be there because you've got no philosophy in place or theology in place that tells you that they have to be there. So that was the first thing that the Christian tradition brought. The second thing that the Christian tradition brought was a sacramental picture of the universe in which natural things, in addition to being God-given, also have their own integrity. They act on each other and can do that. And it's not everything is happening because it's the direct will of God. Things are happening because God invested in creatures their own integrity. So a good image is, you know, what made the statue of the David? Well, in a certain sense, what made the statue of the David was a chisel made the statue of the David. But of course, the chisel was in the hand of Michelangelo. And so there can be first causes in Christian understanding, but there can also be secondary causes. So how did I get here? Well, God made me, you know, Baltimore Catechism. Who made me? God made me. But, you know, the other reason that I'm here is because my parents made me. And when you have those two things in place, the belief that the universe is lawful and also the belief that creatures can act on one another and produce results, then you've got the grounds for science. And again, the idea of secondary causes isn't a given. We've accepted it as a given because we've got generations of Christian tradition in our back pocket, and we're not even aware that it's there. But for example, in Islam never had a scientific revolution, and the reason they didn't was because it became a heretical idea to say that creatures acted on one another directly. That stole glory from God, from Allah. And so the what took root in Islamic culture was the idea that when you set a match to a piece of paper and a flame results and the paper turns black, that's not because the flame is turning the paper black. It's because it's the will of Allah that the paper turn black. And so if you have a notion that creatures can't act on each other directly, that everything is always the direct result of the sovereign power of Allah, you also can't have science, because there's nothing to study. You can't study the relationship between creatures, because it's, there is none. Everything is just Allah working on creatures. And that's why we have the sciences. So anyway, we will be back right after this with Doug O'Brien. You're listening to Breadbox Media, and our show is Connecting the Dots. We'll be back right back in a minute.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Doug O'Brien. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about infallibility, one of the things that Chesterton remarked on, which I think is even more massively true today, is that with the loss of the idea of dogma and of the church's infallibility, Chesterton once remarked that when you get rid of the big laws, you don't get freedom, and you don't get anarchy. You just get the small laws. And in the same way, when you get rid of real dogma and real infallibility, you don't get freedom and you don't get anarchy. You just get fake dogmas and fake infallibility. So he remarked, for example, that one of the marks of the modern world is that you can think whatever you like about Jesus Christ, but there's only one way that you can think about Abraham Lincoln. And that's, you know, and we're seeing that today, you know. So as people form these little ideological bubbles, there are all kinds of little creeds that you have to confess, you know, and little code words and shibboleths that you have to say. So if you're, you know, if you're on the right, you have to repeat shibboleths like fake news. And you have to, you can't talk about immigrants or refugees. You have to call them illegals. You have to use that kind of code language. And if you don't, you're marked out. It's very clear you are a social justice warrior, you are a liberal, you're whatever. And the result of that has been, I think the apotheosis of this that we're seeing now is an administration that is increasingly, it eats, sleeps, and breathes lies. And it tells itself lies. That it tries to make itself believe. And the problem, of course, is that people outside of those bubbles are looking and saying, I don't want to touch that. You were telling me you had a conversation the other day with somebody. I thought it was interesting. I was wondering if you could talk about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, so in the course of my work, I deal with a number of government officials and former government officials. And I was reaching out to one because, as most people know from the press, is that a lot of positions in the new administration have yet to be filled. And we're now getting into crunch time when serious legislation needs to move, including budgets and appropriations and things that really fund the government that are necessary to the functioning of our society. And there are hundreds of positions that require Senate approval that are political positions that must be filled. And otherwise, this nameless, faceless bureaucracy kind of operates on its own without bosses, right? So it seems to me to be in everyone's best interest to move this forward. I should also go as far as to add, we still don't have a Secretary of Agriculture. So when people talk about, you know, hunger and such things, farmers, food systems, we don't have anyone in charge of that department right now. Someone's been nominated, they've been approved by the Senate, but still no one is actually in the big chair. But I was speaking to someone who's a former U.S. ambassador under the Bush administration. He had served prior to that in senior level positions under George W. Bush and was an ambassador. And I was inquiring of him if he was in the running or was interested in working in this administration in a capacity similar to he had under Bush. And as I told you, he started to laugh. to sum up the conversation was essentially, I have zero interest in working in this administration. Not that he doesn't have an interest in the policies, the programs that he is very familiar with and would be a great person to do this. As he shared with me, many of the former Bush administration and senior Republicans, people that have had leadership and executive positions in the states in the Republican Party, but especially the Bush administration folks, just have no interest. And they see this train wreck unfolding. And they, kind of for a lot of them is, this isn't about Republicanism. This is Trumpism. It's a very different beast.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't be part of it. His word was, this is the amateur hour. And you can see as the news has unfolded this past week, with the varying degrees of Russian scandal and whatever else, that it really is an amateur hour in which they don't seem to know what they're doing. And their chaos now is spread to the Hill, where you have the House Intelligence Committee chairman very possibly going to lose his position, all because he was trying to justify a ridiculous tweet from the President of the United States.
Yeah. And it does come from, it comes from the denial of truth.
Yeah.
You've got, you have an administration that is captained by somebody who how should I put it? Bill Clinton lied when he had to, and
lied when he didn't have to too.
Yeah, but not like Trump. There's something wrong with this guy. I mean, he lies about everything when it's completely unnecessary to do it. There was absolutely nothing that demanded that he come up with this ridiculous, obviously baseless lie that Obama had wiretapped him. The weird part of it was that he's so ignorant of how it is that wiretapping occurs that he doesn't seem to have realized that by making this charge, what he was inevitably really saying was some FISA judge thought that there was enough dirt on me that that wiretapping was a good idea. Because he didn't know that the president can't just, pick up the red phone and say, put a wiretap on Trump. Because he doesn't know anything about his own office, what it had to mean either was that he was just a brazen pathological liar, which is the truth, or that there was, in fact, evidence sufficient to convince a FISA judge that a wiretapping was a good idea. And what's incredible has been the fact that, of course, he can produce no evidence because he's a liar. And yet he refuses to back down and say, I lied. Yeah.
And I would say this, why this is really bad for him and for the country. I agree with everything you said, by the way, is that the problem is that you do have serious grown-up people who have been in government, who have, you know, taken on the Democrats, have you know, pushed forward on conservative values and programs and policies, who really don't want to be near him, who, because of all the things you said about his seeming inability and stranger and the fact that he is a stranger to the truth, has right. made the very people that could help him not only not want to have anything to do with him, but actually counting the days until he does implode. Right. That's not, it's good for the, in my view, my humble opinion, it's good for the country in so much as we get him out of office. Right. But it's bad for the country that we would go through such a constitutional crisis and we would go through the inevitable humiliation of having a president who is so unbelievably incompetent that we get to that point.
Well, we went through that humiliation on November 8th, as far as I'm concerned. You know, right now, you know, the faster this guy is broomed from office, the better. But
here's the thing. I held out being, you know, because despair is the poison that Christians cannot drink, right? Instead, I had held out hope that he would bring with him, with a magnanimous sense, people that his vanquished opponents, like a Jeb Bush and a Mitt Romney and others, and bring them into the administration and actually, you know, kind of let them do their thing, you know, acknowledge that they have wisdom and political acumen and abilities and talents, and let them do that. And he could be that kind of standoffish CEO that he said he kind of wanted to be. Instead, we find that has done nothing but further distance those people from him by his own actions. That he is not a hands-off manager, that he actually is way too engaged in stuff, that he has no idea that he's doing. He does not understand the institutional distinction between the executive branch and the other two branches, and understand that our founders, in their wisdom and brilliance, decided these would be co-equal branches. And if you mess with Congress, guess what? They don't just fold like a tent. They will come back and exert their authority. And that will make your life very difficult. And as I was telling you, the challenge with the scandals happening now, and I say this as a former congressional staffer myself, is that the dogged pursuit of this scandal by staff and by members of the House and Senate will be unceasing. It will not stop. This will last. The best he can hope for is 4 years of inquiry and congressional hearings.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best he can hope for.
Yeah. And I think that it's going to spiral far out of control, because he's an actor. He's not merely passive here, and he will do something weird and crazy because that's what he does. I mean, he's an agent of chaos, and he lives by lies.
Superpower.
We'll see what happens, but in the meantime, thank God for the truth of the Catholic faith. It's a touchstone in a crazy, crazy world. We are unfortunately out of time, but I want to thank you for being on the show today, Mr. Doug O'Brien. We'll be back with you next Friday. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today is Mr. Danny Head. And we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a great April Fool's Day. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.